content, parental discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It's 11 p.m. Eastern Time on 20, and thanks for joining us for the 88th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. The show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. Thank you for that. And if you would please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, given the topic title for this evening, I thought it was only appropriate to play Metallica's King Nothing, since we're going to be talking about power, the abuse thereof, and what it really symbolizes and how to resist it.
Yes, exactly. And as Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's topic is King Nothing, Power Corrupts, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So what I thought I'd do tonight is, give a shout out to some bass players. And someone that everybody knows, but they don't know they know, is a bass player known as Donald Dunn, affectionately known as Donald Duck Dunn, so named by his father because of the cartoons he used to watch as a kid. Seriously. And most of you may not know, if you don't know him, he was the bassist for Booker T and the MGs. And was a session, and was a session bass player for Stax Records. But he played with people like Sam and Dave, Rufus Thomas, Carlos Thomas, Eddie Floyd, Otis Redding, Albert King, Elvis Presley, Bill Withers, Eric Clapton. I mean, he's played with a lot of people. And I think in 92 he was inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame vis-a-vis Booker T and the MGs. So, as I mentioned, his father nicknamed him Duck because he was watching Disney cartoons. So, that was sort of the how he got his nickname. He met his Booker T and the MGs guitar playing cohort, Steve Cropper, because they were playing, they were buddies and grew up playing sports and riding bicycles together. So, eventually, when Booker T and the MGs first got together, they didn't. He was not the original bass player. The original bass player was Louis Steinberg, but for whatever reason, he quit, and Duck Dunn replaced him in, I think, '64. And actually, Green Onions has Louis Steinberg on bass, and all the other big hits from Booker T and the MGs have Donald Duck Dunn, who has been with them ever since, and I think is still with them if they're still playing, although he died a couple of years ago, but I think the remaining guys are still together. So basically, has played, as I mentioned earlier, has played on a shoot ton of Stax recordings, Otis Redding's Respect, I Can't Turn You Loose, Sam and Dave's Hold On, I'm Coming, the Albert King song that was then covered later by Cream, Born Under a Bad Sign. I mean, he's played with just about everybody. He played with Presley on Raised on Rock, one of his albums. And when Tom Fogerty left CCR, Creedence Clearwater Revival, initially, in 71, the remaining three members considered bringing him on bass and was going to move Stu Cook, who was the normal bass player, to rhythm guitar to make up for Tom Fogerty, who was a rhythm guitar player and brother of John Fogerty, the founder and lead guitar player, lead singer for Creedence. But they ultimately decided to remain a trio and went on from there. But as I said, Dunduck has played with a shoot ton of people, Jerry Lee Lewis, Rod Stewart, Muddy Waters. He even played on the Stevie Nicks' Tom Petty single, as I like to call it, Stop Dragging My Car Around. he played bass on that recording and on basically the entire Belladonna recording, which was Stevie Nicks' solo album. Played with Leon Helms, RCO, All-Stars Band, and, of course, he's the bass player for, you know, for folks who've seen the Blues Brothers movies. He's the bass player for the band of the Blues Brothers movies, the guy with the pipe. Right, yeah. So that's kind of what he was known for. Always had a pipe and had kind of a semi-fro, so it was kind of interesting.
Nice.
And but I mean, he's played with Dylan. He was the kind of the band, one of the band guys on the Dylan's 30th anniversary in the Music Business show that had Tom Petty and Stevie Wonder on it, and Neil Young and Harrison and Clapton, and he was the bass player for that. Went into quote unquote semi-retirement in the 2000s, but he continued to perform with Booker T and the MGs. He's appeared on Crossroads Festivals, the Clapton's Crossroads Festivals. He was a bass player for Clapton on the record. I think it's Journeyman that has Forever Man on it. That's Donald Duck Dunn playing on that. I mean, he's just played with everybody and their brother. And it was married to the same gal. I think her name was June, and they had one kid. I think his name is Jeff. In 2012, Dunn passed on. He was doing a double bill in the Blue Note Club in Tokyo with Steve Cropper, his bandmate, and basically died at that point. But, he's just been around forever and a day, prior to that, and just really, has just played with a number of people, both live and in the studio, and just has a huge catalog of stuff. He's probably one of the second most played bass players other than Leland Sklar, who is probably on more records than any other bass player on the planet, who's played with James Taylor and Carly Simon and, Ron Zavon. And he was ZZ Toppy before ZZ Top was ZZ Top. He had a beard, way the heck down half his chest before ZZ Top did, and he still got one.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah. He's a really good bass player. But so was Donald Luke Dunn, and, you know, was inspired by people like James Jamerson, and also used flat wound strings like James Jamerson did, which is kind of unusual for bass players unless they're playing fretless basses. So anyway, that's kind of the quick and dirty version of Mr. Dunn, who was very prolific and really talented.
Nice. Okay. All righty. Thank you very much for that. Let me get some applause up and here. Thanks, Dan.
Oh, I often give nods to guitar players and sometimes drummers, and I thought it time to give me some nods to bass players. So we're going to spread the love
around. Yeah, definitely. Yep, you got to get some love to the whole band. Otherwise, somebody's going to
get
sulky and pick their toys and go home. Can't have that. All righty. Okay. Again, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. All righty. So, tonight's episode, King Nothing, Power Corrupts. Tonight's show borrows from the Metallica song King Nothing. Other notable songs from which we may draw stuff tonight, or this may be a two-parter, so possibly also in 2 weeks, is Cult of Personality by Living Colour, or Take the Power Back by Rage Against the Machine, amongst so many other songs about toxic leaders, fascists, abusers of authority and power, and related concepts. This dynamic seems to be socially iconic and rooted in primal power-seeking instincts, bolstered by the psychological manipulation techniques now available to modern people through the science of psychology as well as rhetoric and propaganda. Power corrupts. This is a quintessential trope, slogan, adage, what have you. It is that ingrained in our society, and for good reason. It is a standard which we say we want to move past and evolve beyond, but never seem to collectively make significant progress towards doing so. Abuse of power goes hand in hand with the sycophants who make it possible. Those so caught up in propaganda, rhetoric, confirmation bias, and groupthink that they cannot respond thoughtfully, empirically, or with any ability to consider multiple sides of issues. They become too personally invested in maintaining the illusion in which they already sank their time, energy, ego, and personal reputation. It becomes a self-actualization and self-esteem crisis, eventually. Tonight, we want to analyze why this is. It sounds simple, yet so many people struggle with this concept, especially when it comes to not being sucked up into it and letting it run them. Perhaps it is more that this is simple but not very easy to deal with. So tonight we will discuss, if we have time, first, what is abuse of power and what is its appeal? Second, history, examples, studies, and propaganda, basically of abuses of power throughout the centuries. Third, causes, pathologies, if relevant, and groupthink. And fourth, suggestions for coping with abuse of power, both personally and as a society. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything that you want to say before we get going here.
No, let's get into it.
All right, let's get into it. All righty. So I apologize if we are a little ham-fisted about when we wrap this up, because just going through the studies alone that Dr. Mathis mentioned would be relevant, they're very lengthy. So we will do the best we can to get what we can to you in an hour and then neatly break and get you the rest in 2 weeks. So let's get started. What is abuse of power and what is its appeal? So our Western-based culture heavily promotes the notions of independence and freedom. We want the ability to pursue the things we choose, the things we like, the things we decide are in our own best interests, and we don't want other people, organizations, or government entities taking those choices from us as much as possible. Individuals differ on how much they want to be left to their own devices rather than having the proverbial state, quote unquote, meaning the government in various forms, take care of many things for them. But even choosing the level to which one does this independently versus contributes to a state entity handling matters is a result of independent choices about one's own life. Little irony there. And not every individual wishes the same exact level of autonomy. We all collectively have to navigate this sea of choices because none of us are capable of being a long-term, solitary, and autonomous compound of one person. And so if we want the amenities of living in a society, we have to make certain concessions in order to be mutual enough to get along and get anything done for the greater whole or our own interests. Covering all these things may be more politics and psychology, but we are trying to look at the reasons why people are in the social and legal constructs they have, which in turn will feed the discussion about abuses of power and when those structures go wrong. So in this context, when we talk about power, well, what is power? Power is essentially the permission and resources to accomplish tasks and goals. It relates to these other concepts, self-determination, self-actualization, and self-esteem. So you can certainly see why people take their power personally, because self. They feel it is a measure of their competence and worth to be able to create power for themselves, even in a healthy context. Unhealthy context being a zero-sum game style, where power for one person has to mean automatically removing power from someone else or many others. Here is part of an article that explains further the dynamic of power, as well as touching slightly on the historical precedents. And I trimmed this down because there's quite a bit of history in this article, too. So this was Abuse of Power as Pathology by Bandy X. Lee, MD and M. Divinity. Bandy Lee, MD, is a forensic psychiatrist at Yale School of Medicine and project group leader for the WHO Violence Prevention Alliance. She also authored the textbook, Violence. This article was from psychologytoday.com on October 1st, 2018. And she says in part, quote, power is the capacity to achieve values in collaboration with and in opposition to others. It can be an end in itself, but it is primarily instrumental in attaining other objectives. In the original French, pouvoir, it means to be able, and is a creative, generative, and cohesive force. However, within a group or between groups, this capacity often has an uneven distribution, so that more powerful people in groups have more autonomy than others, as well as more influence over others. When the uneven distribution is extreme and persists over time, it becomes domination, and not the fun kind. Domination or abuse of power then becomes a condition of pathology. Power became a concept for analysis with the work of Machiavelli in 1532, who elucidated how princes and states could exploit its mechanisms. English political philosopher Thomas Hobbes, 1651, held the view that power should be concentrated and institutionalized in a sovereign. Enlightenment philosophers John Locke, Charles-Louis Montesquieu, and the authors of the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, and James Madison in 1788, devised their institutional arrangements of dividing, sharing, and separating power with the aim of avoiding any concentration of power. Military capability also creates an imbalance of power, both domestically and internationally, through threats as well as actual use. When abuse of power comes easily, it also becomes an all too attractive end for pathological individuals who might try to seize it through any means. When they attain a position of control of an entire society, great tragedy can result. We shudder to consider the examples of Adolf Hitler's Germany, Joseph Stalin's Russia, Mao Zedong's China, and Pol Pot's Cambodia. End quote. Can you have power and be benevolent? Sure. It requires equity, cooperation, and common purpose, which can make it a lot more work than simply taking power, as often happens. Not that I'm encouraging this. I'm just explaining why people usually opt for the icky version. In the next section, we will discuss the patterns our society has had of doing this repeatedly, with a breakdown of some of the psychological aspects at work and studies on the topic. And with this, I will break and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, to see if you want to add anything further.
Now I'm going to talk about more stuff and as we move along. So please continue.
Okay. So this part is going to be the longest because I'm quoting the studies that Dr. Mathis gave me. So I will attempt to get through as much of this as possible. So section 2.
Yeah, it's all
two,
my fault.
No, that's not blame. That is, I am learning about these studies. I realize I have heard of both of them before, but not in this level of detail. And I think just throwing it out there, I am of the opinion that one of the failings, I think, of our society and educational system is that these studies have sort of fallen into obscurity because we don't teach our history, so we damn well keep repeating it because we don't learn from it if we don't hear it. Hello?
Yep,
so,
no kidding.
So, with that in mind, section 2, history, examples, studies, and propaganda. Okay, so the notion of leadership, not just simply doing as it wishes and abusing its power, is more or less a somewhat modern notion. There may be a tiny handful of older examples of rebellion against it, but the Renaissance and forward is really when the idea began to take hold, as I mentioned in section 1, where most of those philosophical treatises came from. And, you know, Renaissance and later, you know, the revolution eras and so on. Possibly because people other than nobles were able to travel more freely, and the average person was slowly becoming educated, at least on some level. Again, there may have been moments before, but they were mostly lost to time until roughly the beginning of the 1500s in Western history. This began events that made it even possible for lesser persons to imagine a life outside slavery and serfdom was even possible. In turn, this began to give rise to notions of equity and being entitled to the proceeds of a man's own labor and so forth. Philosophers and other academics began to debate such notions, as many of the nations we know today were undergoing events leading to their modern forms as we now know them. Again, more history than psychology, but we mention this to show the progression of the societal mindset that keeps repeating the mistakes of abuse of power, fascism, groupthink, propaganda, and the like. Rebellion, civil unrest, and misinformation campaigns, including now what we colloquially call gaslighting, is certainly not new. But to keep this from being an even further, a more of a history show than a psychology show, let's just all agree as a given that the history is well documented, that there are centuries of examples in modern Western society of power inequity and abuses of leadership, and a cycle of these all the way up into the present day. Some closer examples to our time period are Japanese propaganda campaigns in World War II. Of course, the Nazis also in World War II, like pretty much every damn thing they did, and are still doing today in their successor groups. Civil rights movement in the 60s. Gay rights starting with Stonewall in 1969. The AIDS crisis in America in the 1980s, just to name a few benchmarks still in our minds today. None of these movements have ever been completely healed or put right, as it were. I know some of these are movements to get freedom, and some of these were things that people did and moved against because they were the oppression that we were fighting, but you get my general point. The theme here is disenfranchisement, inequity, and systemic abuse and classism. And when you ignore the abused and the downtrodden for long enough, they eventually will reach a breaking point and rise up. You don't even need psychology to know that is likely coming. Examples of arenas where this sort of abuse and then in turn some of these rising up events happen is in politics, law enforcement, prisons, clergy, teachers, bosses, business owners, etc. Okay, so here are the studies, and this may take me a while to go through. These are studies that were done years ago and demonstrating some of the psychology behind these behaviors. These are important to absorb because they're going to teach you guys, when you sit around and scratch your head, you go, how in the Kentucky Fried Hell could these people possibly do this stuff? And these are people you know, or you think you know, or you grew up with, you went to college with, or you know, your best friend, something. And then they do this outrageous shit, and you have no idea where it comes from. Buckle up. Here we go. One of the most famous studies of obedience in psychology was carried out by Stanley Milgram, a psychologist at Yale University. He conducted an experiment focusing on the conflict between obedience to authority and personal conscience. Milgram, and the study was 1963 when it came out, examined justifications for acts of genocide offered by those accused at the World War II Nuremberg war criminal trials. Their defense often was based on, quote, obedience. They were just following orders from their superiors. And yes, you have heard that lately, and that's been a common excuse for a long time. The experiments began in July 1961, a year after the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem. Milgram devised the experiment to answer the question, could it be that Eichmann and his million accomplices in the Holocaust were just following orders? Could we call them all accomplices? Milgram, 1974, you know, speaking back to what the question was. Milgram wanted to investigate whether Germans were particularly obedient to authority figures, as this was a common explanation for the Nazi killings in World War II. Milgram selected participants for his experiment by newspaper advertising for male participants to take part in a study of learning at Yale University. The procedure, procedure was that the participant was paired with another person, and they drew lots to find out who would be the learner and who would be the teacher in the experiment. The draw was fixed so that the participant was always the teacher, and the learner was one of Milgram's confederates, pretending to be a real participant. The learner, a confederate called Mr. Wallace, was taken into a room and had electrodes attached to his arms, and the teacher and researcher went into a room next door that contained an electric shock generator and a row of switches marked from 15 volts, which is a slight shock, to 375 volts, danger severe shock, to 450 volts, and it just says XXX, which I assume is a euphemism for that would probably kill you. The aim. Milgram was interested in researching how far people would go in obeying an instruction if it involved harming another person. Stanley Milgram is interested in how easily ordinary people could be influenced into committing atrocities, for example, Germans in World War II. The procedure. Volunteers were recruited for a controlled experiment investigating, quote, learning, Ray ethics deception. Participants were 40 males, aged between 20 and 50, whose jobs ranged from unskilled to professional from the New Haven area, that New Haven, Connecticut, which is where Yale is. At the time, they were paid $4.50 for just turning up. Milgram obedience shock generator. At the beginning of the experiment, they were introduced to another participant who was a confederate of the experimenter, Milgram. They drew straws to determine their roles, learner or teacher. Although this was fixed, then the confederate was always the learner. There was also a, quote, experimenter dressed in a gray lab coat played by an actor, not Milgram. Two rooms in the Yale Interaction Library were used, one for the learner with an electric chair and another for the teacher and experimenter with an electric shock generator. The learner, Mr. Wallace, was strapped to a chair with electrodes. After he had learned a list of word pairs given him to learn, the teacher tests him by naming a word and asking the learner to recall its partner or pair from a list of four possible choices. The teacher is told to administer an electric shock every time the learner makes a mistake, increasing the level of shock each time. There were 30 switches on the shock generator marked from 15 volts to 450 volts. The learner gave mainly wrong answers on purpose, and for each of these, the teacher gave him an electric shock. When the teacher refused to administer a shock, the experimenter was to give a series of orders or prods to ensure that they continued. There were four prods, and if one was not obeyed, then the experimenter, Mr. Williams, read out the next prod and so on. The first one was, please continue. The second, the experiment requires you to continue. Third, it is absolutely essential that you continue. Fourth, you have no other choice but to continue. Results. 65%, which is two-thirds of the participants, in other words, the teachers, continued to the highest level of 450 volts. All the participants continued to at least 300 volts. Milgram did more than one experiment. He carried out 18 variations of his study. All he did was alter the situation to see how this affected obedience.
Let me add a little something right here.
Sure.
So part of the variations was, one was the experimenter was in the room with the teacher, and another one, the experimenter used a microphone to communicate to the teacher, and they found that the compliance to the orders of the teacher was much higher when the teacher was physically in the same room with the person. Also, all the experts, quote unquote, in the field predicted that the participants willing to go to the highest level was something like 18% or something crazy like that, which I thought was hilarious. All these professional, you know, mental health folks says, oh, no, the average person can't be So you can imagine their, you'll excuse the pun, shock when.
No!
But thanks, I'll be here all week. When the results came out from this experiment, it really freaked everybody out and really kind of like brought this thing to the full realization of how impactful this kind of thing is. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Alrighty. So the conclusion. Ordinary people are likely to follow orders given by an authority figure, even to the extent of killing an innocent human being. Obedience to authority is ingrained in us all the way from the way we are brought up. People tend to obey orders from other people if they recognize their authority as morally right and or legally based. This response to legitimate authority is learned in a variety of situations. For example, in the family, at school, and in the workplace. Milgram summed up in the article The Perils of Obedience, written in 1974, writing, quote, the legal and philosophic aspects of obedience are of enormous import, but they say very little about how most people behave in concrete situations. I set up a simple experiment at Yale University to test how much pain an ordinary citizen would inflict on another person simply because he was ordered to by an experimental scientist. Stark authority was pitted against the subject/participant's strongest moral imperatives against hurting others, and with the subject's ears ringing with the screams of the victims, authority won more often than not. The extreme willingness of adults to go to almost any length on the command of an authority constitutes the chief finding of the study and the fact most urgently demanding explanation. Milgram's agency theory. Milgram explained the behavior of his participants by suggesting that people have two states of behavior when they are in a social situation. The autonomous state, where people direct their own actions and they take responsibility for the results of those actions, and the agentic state. People allow others to direct their actions and then pass off the responsibility for the consequences to the person giving the orders. In other words, they act as agents for another person's will.
Let me insert something really quickly here also.
Absolutely.
So for the listeners' peace of mind, no shock was actually ever administered. The person in the other room that was playing the learner was just faking it. So for those of you going, oh my God, what about those poor people getting shocked? Nobody got shocked in the study, but the person administering the shock, the quote unquote, the teacher, didn't know that.
Right. And that I do think actually is in part circulated around. I'm struggling to think of how to describe it. It's not an urban legend because it totally happened, but it is an anecdote that goes around and people have heard of this study, even if they don't remember who did it or when it was or what the point was. But yes, that
absolutely
happened.
Yeah, I just felt the need to say that. Yeah, I just felt the need to say that in case the listeners go, oh my God, what about those poor learners? Just FYI.
Oh, just wait till study number two. You're going to probably have to say it again.
Oh, no, yeah. Study number two is a little more problematic.
Yes. And, this is what we are trying to say to you guys. This actually goes back to other episodes, and I did not have the opportunity to dig them all up, but we've talked about things like, for example, terror management theory and some other stuff, and just a basic underlying psychological premise that in order for us to get up and deal with the world each day, especially, this is relevant right now because there's so much crazy shit going on with all the quarantine and everything. In order for us to function at a basic level, there's a certain amount of lying to ourselves and sleight of hand and things that we have to do to just cope with the world as it really is. And we kind of have to do these little tricks with ourselves and not really look at stuff too close. And then therein lies the problem. Because sometimes when we don't, we don't realize that the capacity to act like this is in there. And it may even be in all of us, and it just takes the right price to activate it. And these are
Absolutely.
Things we don't like to look at. And, we sit around and we get astounded.
Who the heck thinks that they're capable of murder, right? Which is essentially what we're talking about.
Or even just like, Mr. Smith, I grew up next to him and he gave me candy and he petted my dog. And, and then you find out that, he wants to shoot brown people and, all this. You can't understand how the hell it went from Mr. Rogers to, like, a monster. And you can't understand how this happened.
Yep.
I know I have struggled with this because I have seen some outrageous crap said by people I have known for decades or relatives that I grew up with and all kinds of stuff. And what we're trying to show through these studies is that it does not take very much for people to lose the societal veneer that we have to have to get up and function, just to get up and go to work and get that damn paycheck and do the necessary things every week. We have to have this veneer, and this veneer is way more delicate than we want to admit. And even if admit it, we're terrified we'll actually find out. And it's part of what's going on right now. This quarantine has brought a lot of that shit out.
That is exactly what I was about to say, which which I think is part and parcel, which is what has added to the most recent set of circumstances that happened this last week.
Yes. Yes, definitely. And I think also, once it starts to cascade, it's boiling up in other people. There's another aspect that we didn't really talk about just yet that people like to add on. Like, it's a different psychology for the first person to start the riot. But when you have people standing up in one city and then they stand up in another city and it goes okay enough where you think, maybe I could go stand up for myself too. And then those are the adders on later. And it's a different psychology for them because it was in there, but they just didn't want to be first. And there's something about being first that's different for other people.
Yep.
And, that may be something we talk about next time is, the difference in that line between the ones that instigate and the ones that follow.
Yep, absolutely. So why don't you get into Dr. Zimbardo's study, and then we probably will need to wrap it up after that.
Yes. Okay. So the second relevant study is Philip Zimbardo's Stanford University prison experiment. Again, this is one of those anecdotes you probably have heard in part. So the purpose of the study was declared to be Zimbardo and his colleagues in 73 were interested in finding out whether the brutality reported amongst guards in American prisons was due to the sadistic personalities of the guards, i.e. dispositional, or had more to do with the prison environment, i.e. situational. For example, prisoner and guards may have personalities which make conflict inevitable, with prisoners lacking respect for law and order and guards being domineering and aggressive. Alternatively, prisoners and guards may behave in a hostile manner due to the rigid power structure of the social environment in prison. Zimbardo predicted the situation made people act the way they do rather than the disposition, personality. I don't know if he was poked for doing that, for having a assumption ahead of time, but at any rate, he did do some rigor to try to prove it one way or disprove it one way or the other. So the procedure. To study the roles people play in prison situations, Zimbardo converted a basement of Stanford University psychology building into a mock prison. He advertised asking for volunteers to participate in a study of the psychological effects of prison life. The 75 applicants who answered the ad were given diagnostic interviews and personality tests to eliminate candidates with psychological problems, medical disabilities, or a history of crime and drug abuse. 24 men, judged to be the most physically and mentally stable, the most mature, and the least involved in antisocial behaviors, were chosen to participate. The participants did not know each other prior to the study and were paid $15 a day to take part in the experiment. Prisoners were treated like every other criminal, being arrested at their own homes without warning, and taken to the police station. They were fingerprinted, photographed, and, quote, booked. Then they were blindfolded and driven to the psychology department of Stanford University, where Zimbardo had the basement set out as a prison with barred doors and windows, bare walls, and small cells. Here the de-individuation process begins. And actually, I have a quick question, Dr. Mathis, if you happen to know. When they did this part, were people told this was going to happen? Because my first reaction to the whole thing is, how the hell did the neighbors not shoot someone?
Yeah, they were not told at all. So this came as a and they just kind of like, hi, we're here, we're arresting you, bye. They were not told any of that stuff, because I think most of them thought they were just going to say, okay, we'll be at the psychology department 8 o'clock next Saturday, and they had no idea that this was going to happen. So this came as a total shock to them.
God, the things that could have gone wrong, and they're so lucky. I can't even wrap my brain around that. Okay. All right, so that's good for context, because that already starts off pretty shocking. All right, let's continue. Yeah, no pun intended. That's the first experiment. That's different. So when the prisoners arrived at the prison, they were stripped naked, deloused, had all their personal possessions removed and locked away, and were given prison clothes and bedding. They were issued a uniform and referred to by their number only. And I have the urge to sing something from Les Mis now about 24601. Okay. Their clothes comprised a smock with their number written on it, but no underclothes. They also had a tight nylon cap to cover their hair and a locked chain around one ankle. All guards were dressed in identical uniforms of khaki, and they carried a whistle around their neck and a billy club borrowed from the police. Guards also wore special sunglasses to make eye contact with prisoners impossible. Three guards worked shifts of 8 hours each. The other guards remained on call. Guards were instructed to do whatever they thought was necessary to maintain law and order in the prison and to command the respect of the prisoners. No physical violence was permitted. Zimbardo observed the behavior of the prisoners and guards as a researcher and also acted as the prison warden. asserting authority. Within hours of beginning the experiment, some guards began to harass prisoners. At 2:30 a.m., prisoners were awakened from sleep by blasting whistles for the first of many, quote, counts. The counts served as a way to familiarize the prisoners with their numbers. More importantly, they provided a regular occasion for the guards to exercise control over the prisoners. The prisoners soon adopted prisoner-like behavior, too. They talked about prison issues a great deal of the time. They, quote, told tales on each other to the guards. In other words, they were ratting each other out, you know. And snitches get stitches, apparently. They started taking the prison rules very seriously, as though they were there for the prisoners' benefit, and infringement would spell disaster for all of them. Some even began siding with the guards against prisoners who did not obey the rules. Physical punishment. The prisoners were taunted with insults and petty orders. They were given pointless and boring tasks to accomplish, and they were generally dehumanized. Push-ups were a common form of physical punishment imposed by the guards. One of the guards stepped on the prisoners' backs while they did push-ups or made other prisoners sit on the backs of fellow prisoners doing their push-ups. Sort of strikes me as violating the physical violence thing, but I digress. So, asserting independence. Because the first day passed without incident, the guards were surprised and totally unprepared for the rebellion, which broke out on the morning of the second day. Surprise! During the second day of the experiment, the prisoners removed their stocking caps, ripped off their numbers, and barricaded themselves inside the cells by putting their beds against the door. The guards called in reinforcements. The three guards who were waiting on standby duty came in, and the night shift guards voluntarily remained on duty, putting down the rebellion. The guards retaliated by using a fire extinguisher, which shot a stream of skin-chilling carbon dioxide, and they forced the prisoners away from the doors. Next, the guards broke into each cell, stripping the prisoners naked, and took the beds out. The ringleaders of the prisoner rebellion were placed into solitary confinement. After this, the guards generally began to harass and intimidate the prisoners. Special privileges. One of the three cells was designated as a privileged cell. The three prisoners least involved in the rebellion were given special privileges. The guards gave them back their uniforms and beds and allowed them to wash their hair and brush their teeth. Privileged prisoners also got to eat special food in the presence of the other prisoners who had temporarily lost the privilege of eating. The effect was to break the solidarity among prisoners. Consequences of the rebellion. Over the next few days, the relationship between the guards and the prisoners changed, with a change in one leading to a change in the other. Remember that the guards were firmly in control and the prisoners were totally dependent on them. As the prisoners became more dependent, the guards became more derisive towards them. They held the prisoners in contempt and let the prisoners know it. As the guards' contempt for them grew, the prisoners became more submissive. As the prisoners became more submissive, the guards became more aggressive and assertive. They demanded even greater obedience from the prisoners. The prisoners were dependent on the guards for everything, so tried to find ways to please the guards, such as telling tales on fellow prisoners. Prisoner number 8612. Less than 36 hours into the experiment, prisoner 8612 began suffering from acute emotional disturbance, disorganized thinking, uncontrollable crying, and rage. After a meeting with the guards where they told him he was weak, but offered him, quote, informant status, 8612 returned to the other prisoners and said, "You can't leave. You can't quit." Soon, 8612 began to act crazy, to scream, to curse, to go into a rage that seemed out of control. It wasn't until this point that the psychologist realized they had to let him out. A visit from parents. The next day, the guards held a visiting hour for parents and friends. They were worried that when the parents saw the state of the jail, they might insist on taking their sons home. Guards washed the prisoners, had them clean and polish their cells, fed them a big dinner, and played music on the intercom. After the visit, rumors spread of a mass escape plan. Afraid they would lose the prisoners, the guard and experimenters tried to enlist the help and facilities of the Palo Alto Police Department. The guards again escalated the level of harassment, forcing them to do menial, repetitive work, such as cleaning toilets with their bare hands. Catholic priest. Zimbardo invited a Catholic priest who had been a prison chaplain to evaluate how realistic our prison situation was. Half of the prisoners introduced themselves by their number instead of their name. Chaplain interviewed each prisoner individually. The priest told them the only way they would get out was with the help of a lawyer. I'm actually surprised that a priest did that, because that was a lie. Prisoner 819. Eventually, while talking to the priest, 819 broke down and began to cry hysterically, just two previously released prisoners had. The psychologist removed the chain from his foot, the cap off his head, and told him to go and rest in a room that was adjacent to the prison yard. They told him they would get him some food and then take him to see a doctor. While this was going on, one of the guards lined up the other prisoners and had them chant aloud. Prisoner 819 is a bad prisoner. Because of what prisoner 819 did, my cell is a mess, Mr. Correctional Officer. The psychologist realized 819 could hear the chanting and went back into the room when they found him sobbing uncontrollably. The psychologist tried to get him to agree to leave the experiment, but he said he could not leave because the others had labeled him a bad prisoner. Back to reality. That's what the article says. At that point, Zimbardo said, listen, you are not 819. You are his name. And my name is Dr. Zimbardo. I am a psychologist, not a prison superintendent. And this is not a real prison. This is just an experiment. And those are students, not prisoners, just like you. Let's go. He stopped crying, suddenly looked up and replied, okay, let's go, as if nothing had been wrong. An end to the experiment. Zimbardo had intended that the experiment should run for 2 weeks, but on the sixth day it was terminated due to the emotional breakdowns of prisoners and excessive aggression of the guards. Christina Maslach, a recent Stanford PhD brought in to conduct interviews with the guards and prisoners, strongly objected when she saw the prisoners being abused by the guards. Filled with outrage, she said, it's terrible what you are doing to these boys. Out of 50 or more outsiders who had seen our prison, she was the only one who ever questioned its morality. Zimbardo, in 2008, later noted, quote, it wasn't until much later that I realized how far into my prison role I was at that point, that I was thinking like a prison superintendent rather than a research psychologist, end quote. Conclusion. According to Zimbardo and his colleagues, the Stanford prison experiment revealed how people will readily conform to the social roles they are expected to play, especially if the roles are as strongly stereotyped as those of the prison guards. Because the guards were placed in a position of authority, they began to act in ways they would not usually behave in their normal lives. The prison environment was an important factor in creating the guards' brutal behavior. None of the participants who acted as guards showed sadistic tendencies before the study. Remember, they did give them a psych evaluation before they could do this. Therefore, the findings support the situational explanation of behavior rather than, you know, it was a situation rather than their predetermined temperament going into it. And with this, I'm going to pause and talk to Dr. Mathis, and then we will probably pause the show and do the rest in 2 weeks. So let's talk to you, Dr. Mathis.
Well, I think that ultimately neither the Milgram nor the Zimbardo studies would fly today for obvious reasons. But
yeah.
I have to say, yeah, no kidding, right? But I have to say that I'm glad that they were done. I feel bad for the folks that were involved in it that probably had some very long-lasting issues. But they really set the precedent for proving a point that you can take the average ordinary Joe or Jolene, and under the right circumstances, those folks could be coerced into being things that they never thought possible. So when these folks say, oh, I could never do that, and how could these people you know, do this or do that, or how could folks not retaliate or whatever, you don't really know what you would do in the right situation, given the particular parameters of the environment and your mental status at the time and what's involved and the whole nine yards. And certainly we can predict that certain people will be more resistant to that than others, but none of us are completely immune from that. I don't care how strong we are. I don't care how smart we think we are. Every one of us is subject to this if we are not fully mindful at all times. And even sometimes then we get sucked into it because it's easy to get into the milieu of the moment and forget who we are. So I think this is a good warning for us as people and a good example of how sometimes people in authority positions can eventually end up abusing that authority and do more damage than good.
Absolutely. And I also think it is something of a cautionary tale for people that are very quick to have derogatory things to say to people that are lashing out now.
Right.
Remember that many, many of them have spent their entire lives being a variation of what it's like to be raised as the prisoner side of the experiment. They don't know anything else. And the concept that they might be able to do something about it, they're desperate. And yeah, they'll do some horrible things because, you know, what did they have to lose?
Yeah, if you belong to it, you know. Well, yeah, and so if you look at people who belong to a, for lack of a better term, a more disenfranchised group in society, whether it's due to socioeconomic status, which is usually the case, or whether it's due to some prioritized racial minority or nationality or gender identity or spiritual religious orientation or ethnicity or, you know, gender or whatever, you can see where folks who are already in a one or two down situation they don't feel like they have a lot of options, so their options are to rebel and to get very, you know, noisy about it, so to speak. And you know, they end up doing the very things that they accuse people of doing, the other people of doing, which is using violence to solve their problems. And, you know, we know from history that that's really not a great option, and it really dilutes your cause when you do that. But it's understandable why folks would resort to that if they feel helpless.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, it can also be used against you. Like, once we know that people will resort to that now, other people know that too. So then when we talk next time about, you know, propaganda and groupthink,
right,
and other stuff like that, there are people who use that very psychological fact to insert infiltrators and double crossers and people masquerading as other groups just to make it messier because we don't have enough going on. So, you know, this whole thing is a giant thing of soup, and we hope that we could do some kind of justice to sort of help it make sense to you. So I think I'm going to pause it here and, you know, kind of just remind you guys that we still want to talk about groupthink. We're going to talk about propaganda and some ways that we can try to help ourselves not get sucked into it as much as we can help that. I want to check with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything else about tonight's part of the discussion that you want to jump in with before we wrap this up.
No, I just want to say, stay tuned, folks. The best is yet to come.
Yes, 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 yes. All righty. So on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, I want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later through podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks for a new topic of discussion, which will be part two of this one, on Wednesday, June 24th, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. Travel Itch Radio, Thursday the 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Seeking Serenity Now in a World Turned Upside Down? Come to Kansas and connect with the state's award-winning byways. The Sunflower State has a dozen, three of which won recent awards. Hear more on Thursday, June 11th, when Sue Stringer joins Travel Itch Radio for a 30-minute talk with Dan Schlossberg and Keita Roberts. On Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday Morning Extravaganza, Saturday morning the 13th at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. No one is safe, and so on and so forth. Roger Noriega, you crazy mofo. All right, so that's Roger's gig. And then Walking Dead still on hiatus. Episode 16, A Certain Doom, is coming in the summer of 2020. I don't know when. I will let you guys know when they announce it, as well as eventually the new third Walking Dead series, World Beyond, that we'll also be covering, and the season 6 of Fear. Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega, June 1st. Oh, no, we already covered that. Never mind. I don't know when the next one is, but there will be a Monday Night in America coming soon. It's either going to be this Monday or next Monday. Roger Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. So please look for us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrank.com. Good night, everybody. Thank you for joining us. See you next time, and rock on.